From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, Senate Republicans are taking up a $4 trillion non-binding budget that sets the stage for GOP tax cut legislation later this year. This morning, President Trump tweeted, "Republicans are going for the big budget approval today. First step toward massive tax cuts. I think we have the votes, but who knows?" Joining us now, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And again, this budget is non-binding, so does it matter what's in it, what the details are?
Yes, because it's a guideline to what the Republicans are going to do when they come back with the actual spending bills. It is essentially the framework on which all of that will be held. And it also matters because it's going to give special instructions for the voting that will take place on the tax overhaul that's coming up later this year.
So will it pass? We know that one Republican, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, has come out against it. He wants more cuts. And President Trump says he doesn't know if he has the votes.
That's right. But Rand Paul's opposition is pretty much a feature of the landscape on just about anything the leadership wants. And the other votes that they worry about, John McCain, Susan Collins, Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, all those people are on board or probably going to be on board and just holding out for one last concession. And it certainly should pass because it pretty much has to pass for the Senate Republicans to be able to say that they're running the Senate. And it's going to come down to something pretty much just like that. And the most important thing is those instructions on voting on the tax overhaul.
And the reason that they have to pass this budget in order to make it easier to pass tax cuts is because it allows them to pass tax cuts with just 51 votes instead of getting all the way up to 60, right?
And that means really just 50, because then if it's a 50-50 tie, they can bring right. in Mike Pence. The vice president breaks that tie. So this is the same thing that they did with the last budget round to set up their attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare. That's why that only needed 50 votes. Of course, it didn't get 50
right.
votes, but that's why it only needed 50 votes and there was no filibuster.
Meanwhile, yesterday, President Trump backed away from that bipartisan deal on health care subsidies under pressure from conservatives. The Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, says a deal is still possible. Is it?
Yes. And in fact, it might still be probable when you look at everything else that has to happen between now and the end of the year. Two serious people, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Patty Murray of Washington State, a Republican and a Democrat, have spent a lot of serious time here, and they have put together a deal that could attract probably the support of just about everybody in some sense, with the exception of those who would just as soon see the payments that are being made to insurance companies to subsidize lower income people getting health care go away. And most people don't want that, including President Trump. But he wants to force the Senate to do something on Obamacare. And this is his latest attempt to do that. But as we get to the end of the year, we're going to have a big overall omnibus deal that has to happen to fund the government. That is also going to raise the debt limit, if that's necessary, at the end of the year. And that is going to accomplish everything they have to do to go home at the end of the year. And that sort of must-pass bill is probably going to need some Democratic votes. One way to get those Democratic votes would be to put the Lamar Alexander, Patty Murray deal bill into that big overall bill.
So we'll be watching that as we go into the month of December. Meanwhile, President Trump is meeting with the Democratic governor of Puerto Rico today on Capitol Hill this morning. Governor Ricardo Rossello said there is still a lot of hurricane recovery work ahead.
We really want to take all the big picture into consideration. And again, recognizing that we're in this together, U.S. citizens in Texas, U.S. citizens in Florida, U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, we need equal treatment. We need all of the resources so that we can get out of the emergency. And of course, the resources to rebuild stronger than ever.
Now, President Trump says the recovery has been going great in Puerto Rico, but some of the stories on the ground indicate otherwise. What's the significance of this meeting today?
It's an important opportunity for the governor to get real commitments from the people who are running Washington that his constituents will be treated as the U.S. citizens they are. And for Republicans in the Capitol and at the White House, it's a chance to repair some of the impression that they've created that they don't think of Puerto Ricans the same way they think of Texans and Floridians.
One more thing, Ron. We heard today from former President George W. Bush, who weighed in on politics and seemed to take some shots at President Trump, though not by name. Here he is.
Bullying and prejudice in our public life sets a national tone, provides permission for cruelty and bigotry, and compromises the moral education of children. The only way to pass along civic values is to first live up to them.
What do you make of that?
Well, some of us remember George W. Bush running for president in 2000 as the compassionate conservative, and that is the legacy that he would like to have people remember.
Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, the New York Times has been under attack this week from the right-wing provocateur James O'Keefe, whose MO is getting people from what he perceives to be left-leaning institutions to expose bias. He secretly videotaped those Acorn housing activists, but several investigations found the tapes had been selectively edited and cleared the group of his corruption charges. Well, every day this week, O'Keefe has released so-called sting videos on Twitter, which purport to show New York Times employees violating their objectivity. Earlier this month, ESPN suspended commentator Jemele Hill for calling Donald Trump a white supremacist on Twitter. Last month, the New York Times' Glenn Thrush quit Twitter after opening yet another vile tweet. So where are we on media organizations and social media? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. And David, you remind us many organizations are reexamining social media. What are they doing?
Well, just in recent days, the New York Times issued what it called new social media guidelines. Have been in the works for a while. It's my understanding that it was perhaps hastened in some ways by the emergence of these James O'Keefe so-called sting videos. I got to say, a lot less there than hyped, and a lot less there than meets the eye, but nonetheless a source of concern. And part of the deal was the Times was telling people, hey, you really do represent us on these platforms. You may think of it as a place to do stand up. You may think of it as a place to get some edge, to get out, to vent some frustration, whether it be about corporate brands or particularly politicians and hypocrisies or seeming injustices. But you got to remember you represent the paper first and foremost. Wall Street Journal also came forward with a memo just in the last 24 hours telling people, hey, you're spending too much time on Twitter. We're thinking about this stuff too much. Let's cut back. Let's remember where your first charge is.
Well, staying with James O'Keefe, full disclosure, he released a video of the NPR Foundation president Ron Schiller back in 2011. In it, Schiller speaks negatively about Tea Party members when speaking to O'Keefe's activists posing as a Muslim group. Now, as you reported at the time, even Glenn Beck's website had questions about the editing. Schiller was actually quoting Republicans who were critical of Tea Party members. That part was edited out. But it didn't matter because Schiller ultimately voiced his agreement with them. He resigned. NPR's then CEO, Vivian Schiller, no relation, resigned. I'm just wondering, isn't it a good thing in a funny way, even though this was false editing, that NPR can then remind people it doesn't matter where you are, even if you're off air, you can't voice an opinion?
I don't think we need somebody as disingenuous and as intellectually dishonest as James O'Keefe to somehow remind us of first principles. And the first principles are those of fair-mindedness and of journalistic curiosity and open inquiry and you know, fair-mindedness to your sources, to the subject of your stories, and also to your audiences and trying to explain things in a fair-minded way. You know, James O'Keefe is set on tearing down institutions, trying to tar ones that are active. Activists as illegitimate, trying to tar ones that are journalistic as advocacy groups, and really it's part of his own fundraising campaign. You see it in his own videos. I don't think want to give him any credence for what he's doing. I do think that we're in an age where people online find their every 140 character tweet, every Instagram posting reviewed often by critics on a lot of sides, particularly from the right when it comes to the media, to look at questions of legitimacy, look at questions of whether bias can be imputed. And I think that that's a part very much when you see so much criticism coming from the White House and particularly from the president about the attacking the integrity and the standing of the press, that that's the climate in which a lot of this stuff occurs.
But it gets confusing because reporters, employees, fundraising arms maybe shouldn't be, you know, voicing their opinions. But Jemele Hill was a commentator. And so, some people, that's their job.
Well, I think Jemele Hill of ESPN got in trouble with the network in part because she was voicing strong thoughts about race and society on a platform that wasn't the platform she was being paid to do that. That is, ESPN seemed to be fine with her doing that as part of her show, what's called SportsCenter 6, but not fine with her doing it on what's sort of a private – or her personal outlet and sort of not. Here's the real problem in some ways. News organizations have actually been pushing their journalists to be more present online, to engage more with listeners, readers, and viewers, to be more authentic, to speak more in their own voices and less in the stilted voices of formal newspaper prose, and yet at the same time they get anxious about the consequences. And the real tension in some ways is that some audiences say this is biased, to know where you're coming from, and other, particularly younger members of audiences, are saying, if you're not your authentic self with us, we're not going to trust you. And news organizations have pressured journalists to be out there and then are recoiling a bit at the reaction. And I think you're seeing the pendulum swing a bit back away from that fuller engagement online, where a lot of times news organizations had been very much explicitly pressuring their folks to do so.
Well, and some like Glenn Thrush are seeing it as exhausting. And as he said, it hijacks your day, his day, when he gets these tweets. He's off. We'll continue to follow this. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This summer, we spoke with poet and author Kwame Alexander about his wildly successful book, The Crossover. When he visited a middle school, we saw his impact on kids.
That was icy cold.
You're Kwame Alexander?
Kwame Alexander?
I read your book, The Crossover.
Crossover!
Yes. I read
it.
So, Kwame is a rock star. His latest book, co-written with Mary Rand Hess, is the story of Blade, a high school senior in L.A. from a family of rock and roll royalty. Sounds great, but think Ozzy Osbourne at his worst. The family crown is tarnished, Blade's dad washed up and addicted, Blade mortified, and there's a family secret. Now, all kids are trying to find their identities. Blade has to do that with his wacky but loving Ozzy Osbourne-like dad in a village in Ghana. Kwame Alexander joins us. And we understand the seed for your story was planted when you visited Ghana with Juanita Britton, the African-American entrepreneur. She was made the queen of a village in Ghana?
Yes. Yes. She was made the queen mother of a village called Timber Nkwanta. And well, that's how I ended up in Ghana.
Well, you fall in love with this village, and we're going to link people to what came of it. You built a library there. You started literacy organizations. But the village then factors in to your story. But we start in L.A. So who is Blade Morrison? He writes in his, you know, kind of typically morose teenage writing, you know, how does it feel to be the son and daughter of a fallen rock star? Tell us more about this teenager.
Blade Morrison is the son of a poor, rich man, and he's trying to find himself amidst these first world problems that he has. His father's a rock star. You know, he comes from this wealthy family. He's got everything going for him. He's headed to a great four-year university. He's having issues in his life amidst all of these, my agent calls them champagne problems. But the issues are issues that all kids kind of deal with. Who am I? What is my place in this world? Who's going to love me? Who am I going to love? And what happens to a 17-year-old kid when your family just, you know, as my daughter, when she was a teenager, used to say, starts kirking off? Your family just doesn't get it. They're crazy. Or at least that's how you view them.
Right.
All these things sort of come crashing down on him at the same time.
And there's also a heavy dose of something that's very typical at this age as well. How did I get in this family? I don't belong in this family. And here we come to another truth about Blade. Now, I normally don't give plot points away in a book, but I really...
Spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler. So if you don't want to hear, if you're already like, I'm getting that book and I don't want to know anymore, I want to have it unfold for me. But Kwame, I want people to know what a great book this is about teens, but also what a great book it is about adoption, mixed-race kids in white families, because that's the family secret, that Blade's skin is darker and his hair is curlier because he was adopted. And now he's on a journey to find, really, truly find his identity and to find his black biological mother who's moved to Africa, which brings Blade and his wacky father and you, because you're there too, because you went to Ghana. Tell us more about that finding identity part of this.
You know, I've been to Ghana 5 times, and this place is rich in love. It's rich in humility. It's rich in kindness and caring. And I got to write a lot of that from personal experience because I spent time, you know, trying to walk with a bucket of water on my head. watching the smiles of these 200 children that I met in the village of Conco. You know, Nikki Giovanni has a poem where she says, someday somebody's going to write a poem about how poor I was and not know how happy I was all the time. So I saw this joy in these children's eyes, and it just lit me up amidst all of the poverty that they're dealing with. And I said, I got to write about that. And so Blade is on a journey to find his family, to find himself. And that journey takes him to Ghana.
Everything comes alive. He comes alive. This place comes alive. Did you really see a sign near a small lake that read, no drowning?
Yes. It exists. It's you stop at a traffic light or you get to an intersection. There are people who are selling everything from coat hangers to sunglasses to plantain chips, anything you could possibly need.
Mm. Well, and also a lot of wisdom. One of the things Blade hears from a new friend is, Blade, you cannot build a house for last year's summer. Telling him to maybe also forgive his father, not just his birth mother. How did you know so much about, you know, the feelings of someone who's been adopted?
You know, I get that kind of question a lot. I tend to think that, Robin, people laugh, smile, love, hurt, cry, pretty much the same. Mm. You know, what Blade's dealing with, I dealt with when I was 17 years old, trying to figure out what's next, feeling jilted. I remember going to my girlfriend's or who I thought was my girlfriend's house and my best friend opening her door. And that totally just destroyed my world. That's a real thing, regardless of whether you're black or white or whether you live in Shanghai or in Southeast D.C. Right. That feeling of being jilted is real. As it relates to Blade being adopted, I think, Robin, that when the writing gets good, when you really get into the rhythm of it, when you're really being true to the character, the truths are revealed.
And by the way, we should say it's not all neat and tidy. I mean, this is a to-be-continued kind of book as people try to make their way through their discoveries. But I want to talk for a second about the music. Blade is also a musician. He's a songwriter. It's kind of sappy, but, you know, perfect.
You called him sappy.
Well,
he is in high school.
Your eyes, they mesmerize me. Yes, your eyes hypnotize me, your eyes.
So, yeah, the music played such an integral role in creating this novel in verse. When we got down to recording the audiobook, I knew that we needed to sort of bring the lyrics off the page and bring them onto the stage. So my buddy, Randy Preston, we went into a studio in Nashville and recorded some of these songs. And I know on paper, Robin, they may look a little cheesy.
No, they look teenage-y.
They're teenager. Yeah. Exactly. But when you hear them, Robin, they come alive and it makes you feel like, you know, you're not riding solo anymore. You know, music is a way to connect us all.
Well, your book has the lyrics, but the audiobook has the song. So let's listen.
Excuse me. I mean, what did you say? I'm sorry. Just a little blown away. 'Cause your eyes.
But he also refers to all the music that is the soundtrack of his life. Bob Dylan's I Was Young When I Left Home, Tina Turner, Bryan Adams, Fleetwood Mac's Landslide. Really interesting because this is a kid in L.A. in recent times and Blade's kind of a throwback kid. But you've told us that you were inspired by that scene in Say Anything when John Cusack holds up the boombox and plays Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes. Let's listen. It's always great to hear it again. Let's listen.
I get so lost sometimes.
Talk about the music, because it's obviously you're so marinated in it.
Yeah, well, I grew up listening to a lot of gospel music. My father was a Baptist minister, and so there wasn't a whole lot of secular music in the house until I got to high school and discovered Prince and Michael Jackson and The Police and Genesis and rock and roll. 80s rock became the music that sort of was the soundtrack to my life, to the lives of my friends. You know, we played tennis listening to I Wear My Sunglasses at Night under the lights, 10 o'clock at night. So this music became the music that defined us, that made us feel cool. And I knew I wanted to pay a tribute to that music.
So obviously music, the soundtrack of your life, and you make it the soundtrack of Blades, and he knows every detail. And he sets up certain experiences in his life by citing a song. In this case, we want to hear when he was having to write a song for his upcoming high school graduation. Would you read that?
Track one, Thinking of You, rocker Lenny Kravitz, album 5, label Virgin America, recording date 1998, studio Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas. While we're writing the song that I'm to play in less than 9 hours in front of 3,000 people, the song that I've decided to dedicate to my mom, Uncle Stevie plays some Lenny for inspiration, then explains that most people only know that Lenny wrote it about his mother, but no one knows that she was an actress on a sitcom called The Jeffersons, or that one of his bandmates actually played Heineken bottles on the track, which would be a pretty cool story if I hadn't heard him tell it a million times. My dad jets for the pool and a cig because the song makes him think of her. So, yeah, the way I ended up coming up with this idea to write these poems I call track poems, where I take a song and give you the story behind it while still moving the story of Blade along. I was in a bookstore in Radnor, Pennsylvania, a small independent bookstore, and Dylan had just won, I believe, the Nobel Prize. And I saw this huge book, 1,500 pages, and it's like $100. And it was every Dylan song and the story behind each of the songs, from where he recorded it, who he was with, what he meant by this particular lyric. And I was immersed in it and felt like, okay, I knew a little bit more about him because I knew a little bit more about why he wrote these songs. And I knew that was going to play a role in this book, in Solo, to help us further understand, you know, what makes Blade tick.
The book is Solo, When the Heart Gets Lost, Let the Music Find You, from Kwame Alexander, his latest for teens. Kwame, it's terrific. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, Robin.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The Kansas City Chiefs play the Oakland Raiders tonight in Thursday Night Football, and again, much of the attention will be focused on what happens before kickoff. Will players take a knee or sit during the national anthem? This controversy continued yesterday with tweets by President Trump, who said the NFL and its players are disrespecting the flag and the country. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell responded.
We believe that our players should stand for the national anthem. That's an important part of our game and our moments, and we believe in that.
Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Mike, when we listen to Roger Goodell there, he's saying yet again, they want the players to stand for the anthem, but it sounds like the owners are reluctant to force them to stand for the anthem.
Well, beyond that, there's a collective bargaining agreement, so it's unclear. In fact, it's unclear what would happen if they were to force them, and I think most experts I've been listening to would say there would be a grievance, and that grievance might be honored. So this isn't just a question of, you know, compelling players to do the thing that they have to do that their employer says. They're in a union, and there are laws at stake.
Well, owners and players met on Tuesday. What did the players want out of this?
Well, this is the first time players have been to an owners meeting like this, and players essentially want a voice, which is the reason that they've been conducting these protests. It's pretty coherent what the protests have been about. They've been about police brutality and issues important, especially to the black community. I know that some conservative activists try to paint them as a disparate set of grievances. That's not true. And at this meeting, owners have said that there are ways to address the players' concerns. And maybe the hope is, because the owners perceive this to be, and I think it's an accurate perception, that it's certainly not helping business, right? Ratings are down a little bit. There are a lot of reasons, like cord cutting, and ratings for every TV show except The Bachelor is down. But still, the owners would like to take this out of the national conversation. They'd like football to go back to being what it still is, the number one watched show in America, without this bit of controversy around it. And so they think that maybe if they reach out to the players, give them a platform, talk about things, maybe help them lobby Congress or talk about issues even like bail reform, that perhaps some of the players who've been leading the protests will say, okay, we'll stand for the anthem.
Do you think the ratings are down further because of this controversy? Are people saying, I don't want to watch this if the players are going to kneel before the anthem?
Well, people are saying that, but I don't know how much I believe them. I mean, there are a lot of people on Twitter or, you know, dyed-in-the-wool conservatives or huge Trump fans who will say that. There was a poll that said that a large portion of ratings being down was because of this. But if you really crunch the math, it wound up being maybe 2% of the ratings being down. They're down 7% this year. They're down 6% last year. And I don't put it out of the realm of possibility that if the guy with the biggest megaphone in America constantly chastises the NFL, that 1% or 2% of the people will respond. That seems plausible to me.
Is this controversy going to continue all season, do you think?
I think so. I can't see someone like Michael Bennett or Malcolm Jenkins or one of the more vocal players who are really tuned into issues saying, okay, this is going away, unless there's some major concession or initiative on the part of owners. And since, as we heard Goodell saying, we'd like them to stand, but we can't compel it.
Right.
I don't think that, you know, Michael Bennett, driven as he is, just take one example, by activism, would say, okay, I'll do just what you want.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the Daily Podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
And next week, we will be broadcasting from Kansas City. And to help us get ready on this week's Here and Now DJ sessions, we're going to take a look at the history of Kansas City's famous jazz scene.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
Chuck Haddix is DJ and host of The Fish Fry on KCUR. He's also curator of the Marr Sound Archives at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Kansas City Jazz and Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. So he's an expert. Chuck, welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be here with you today.
And put this in context for us. When people think of influential jazz cities, where does Kansas City rank?
Well, Kansas City was one of four cradles of jazz. Jazz was born in New Orleans, traveled by rail to Chicago, and then moved on to New York and then Kansas City. And Kansas City developed a very unique style of jazz. It evolved very quickly from ragtime to bebop in a 20-year period of time between 1920 and 1940. In 1920, James Scott composed Don't Jazz Me Rag, I'm Music. By 1940, Charlie Parker was playing bebop in the Jay McShann Band.
All right, well, let's get to some of the music. This is Moton Swing, performed by Benny Moton and his Kansas City Orchestra. Now, Benny Moton was a pianist and band leader from Kansas City. Why did you choose this song to start?
Well, this really heralds in the golden age of Kansas City's hard swinging style. It was recorded in Camden, New Jersey, 1932, at the end of a long, hard tour east. And they had become stranded in the East Coast and had to hitch a ride to the recording session. And they were so hungry that right before it, they cooked up a stew and stood around a pool table and dipped bread in the stew before they went into the session. And this is based on the changes of the pop standard You're Driving Me Crazy, and it contains all the hallmarks of the Kansas City style. Also, this was recorded in 1932, 3 years before the King of Swing, Benny Goodwin, would make his debut nationally, and swing would enter the national vernacular.
And what is the difference between swing and ragtime?
Well, ragtime is a piano music that is strictly composed. The ragtime professors would write out their music, and they didn't want any variation on that music, whereas jazz is an improvised art form, particularly swing. And in the Kansas City tradition, the bands used what they called head arrangements, arrangements that were memorized or sketched out, and they would collectively improvise upon that head arrangement.
All right, well, Benny Moten's band included Count Basie, and the next song we have is another song with Count Basie. This is called 1 o'clock Jump. Count Basie wrote this song in 1937 based on a number of musical riffs from his fellow band members. You can hear those repeated phrases there. Was that a main feature of Kansas City jazz?
Yeah, the contrasting riffs and solos, outstanding solos, and a driving rhythm section, really the hallmark of the Kansas City style. Basie actually wrote this as a member of the Benny Moten band along with Eddie Durham and Buster Smith, and originally it was called Blue Balls. And they were broadcasting one night, and the announcer said, "What's the next selection?" And Basie said, "Blue Balls." And he said, "You can't say that over the air." So he looked up, legend has it, he looked up at the clock. It was 1 o'clock, so he called it 1 o'clock Jump.
Can we say now, that over the air? I don't know if we can. But we just did, so there you go.
I think, to quote Cole Porter, anything goes today pretty much. But it does have those infectious riffs that are really the hallmark. And also has a very relaxed swing. By the time Basie came on the scene in 1937, swing had become rather stale. And Basie really redefined it with this particular hit, 1 o'clock Jump. And it was also the big hit that established the band nationally.
All right, well, let's go now to the song Roll 'em Pete. This is by Pete Johnson and Big Joe Turner.
I've got a gal lives up on that hill. I've got a gal lives up on that hill. Well, they both try to quit me, Lord, but I love her still. She got eyes like diamond teeth, shine like lime dyed gold. Got eyes like diamond teeth, shine like lime dyed gold. Every time she loves me, she sends my mellow soul.
Now that's Big Joe Turner singing there. Why did you choose this song?
Well, it typifies the blues and boogie-woogie that was the foundation of the Kansas City style. Big Joe was a singing bartender, and Pete Johnson was featured on the keyboards, and sometimes they would roll the blues for 128 choruses and not repeat themselves, and this really kind of captures that, what I call the intemperate spirit of Kansas City jazz.
And they could be found, Johnson and Turner could be found at the Sunset Club in Kansas City, one of many at the time.
Oh, yeah, Kansas City. Musicians flocked here because the city was lorded over by a corrupt democratic machine that fostered, well, basically graft, corruption, and clubs. And so musicians from the Southwest came to Kansas, flocked to Kansas City because they could work here. They found work here. Mary Lou Williams recalls 50 clubs featuring live music between 12th and 18th Street.
So it was a party town.
It's definitely a party town. It's known as the Paris of the Plains, not for our broad boulevards and fountains, but for the kind of laissez-faire attitudes of the citizens, their indifference to all the wild things happening in Kansas City during that time.
All right, we have time for one more, and this is the saxophone player Charlie Parker. Everybody knows Charlie Parker. This is called Yardbird Suite. I said everybody knows Charlie Parker, but did you know that Charlie Parker was born in Kansas City in 1920, born and raised there?
In many ways, Charlie Parker is a culmination of the Kansas City tradition. He was really schooled during late-night cutting contests where musicians gathered in these clubs and jammed, and that's really where he was a great soloist as a result. He was also the inventor of bebop. Yardbird Suite was originally written by Bird when he was a member of the McShann Band. The band had been on tour down south, and he was brutalized by a policeman. And he, in response, wrote a song called What Price Love, which later became Yardbird Suite. And it's really Bird at his most lyrical.
So we've been talking about all of these classic jazz musicians from Kansas City. What's the jazz scene like there now?
The jazz scene's very strong now. You can go out and hear jazz any night of the week at several different clubs. The Green Lady Lounge packs them in every night, and so does the Phoenix and the Blue Room. And a lot of that's fueled by Bobby Watson, who's head of the UMKC Jazz Department. And he attracts all the young players from across the country. They come and want to study with Bobby, and they go out into the community and jam, just as musicians have in Kansas City back in the 1920s. Shall we say the tradition jams on?
Well, hopefully we will be able to take in some jazz next week in Kansas City when we are there broadcasting Wednesday and Thursday. Chuck Haddix, DJ and host of The Fish Fry on KCUR, thank you so much. We look forward to visiting.
Looking forward to seeing you.
And again, you can hear us from Kansas City next week.
The wildfires in Northern California hit Napa's wine country at one of its busiest times for tourism. But the impact on the wine industry, while terrible for some, you've seen pictures of empty, burned-out bottles, hasn't been as bad as it could have been. Let's check in. Jim Lapsley is a researcher at the Agricultural Issues Center at the University of California, Davis. Jim, we know the industry has been impacted, but what are you hearing in terms of damage?
Well, in terms of physical damage to the industry, meaning being burnt by fire, very little. But the vineyards that have been burnt or have had any fire damage have been up in the hills, and probably 90% of the total acreage is down in the valley and hasn't been touched by the fire. The real issue for the industry right now is potential damage from smoke on the grapes. At the time of the fire, according to the Napa Valley Vintners and Industry Organization, about 90% of the harvest was complete, but 10% of the grapes were still out hanging. And it's possible that the smoke can affect the grapes with something called smoke taint.
Yeah, well, and you say that smells like an ashtray, so that's probably not going to be something people want. But I want to be clear here. So there are 900 vintners, you know, across the area. And many didn't get damaged, but also vineyards act as sort of a fire break.
Yes. First of all, the way that most vineyards are grown these days is that the ground between the rows will be plowed. So it's open ground. It doesn't have vegetation. But if you have a wind that is being blown at, say, 70 to 80 miles an hour, it's like a blowtorch. And if you hold a blowtorch to a vine, it will burn.
Yeah.
But again, most of the vineyards, I think, are going to come out just fine.
Well, that's good to hear, even though there are individuals, and we've seen them, you know, who've lost a lot. But we are hearing the industry in general coming out and trying to get the message out. Please come. We're still open for business. And this is big business in Napa and Sonoma counties. Tourism, $3.2 billion a year. Do you think it's realistic to ask people to come?
I think that the tourism is going to have to be scaled back to some degree for a while. most of the buildings that have been burned haven't been wineries or winery outbuildings. They've been homes, and especially over in Santa Rosa, and also hotels. And then there's also the issue currently right now of smoke, but that's going to clear out.
Yeah. Well, so if you're planning a trip, you know, check with the hotels and maybe somebody who helped you organize that trip to make sure. Jim Lapsley, researcher at the Agricultural Issues Center at the University of California, Davis. Jim, thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, seasonal workers in the wine industry are eager to get back to work, especially those who don't get paid for non-work days. Farida Jabala Romero from member station KQED reports.
Valley of the Moon is one of the oldest wineries in the region. It was closed last week because of the fires. There was no electricity and limited access because of evacuations and road closures. Now, parts of this winery are returning to life, slowly. At the tasting room, they're expecting a busload of Danish tourists.
And that's why we're here, because there was a group that made a reservation for today.
Vanessa Garcia works here pouring wine, and she's a seasonal worker. Garcia had to evacuate her nearby home. Because she didn't work last week, she's not expecting to get paid. So she's really glad to get back to work.
To come back today, it's just been very relieving to see my team and see my tasting room where I work standing and everything okay.
This winery wasn't damaged by the fires, but other grape growers in this valley have sustained damages. That means many seasonal agricultural workers have been out of their jobs. Some vineyard owners have said they'll pay workers anyway. Valley of the Moon's general manager, Dave McDonald, says grape growers and winery owners will try to help in the long term.
Every company in this industry will do their best to help, you know, absorb some of that workforce and help to find some work for others that need it.
Near the winery's cellar, Luis Guerrero is using a big metal hose to fill wine barrels with crushed grapes. He's another seasonal worker here.
Entonces la semana toda la que perdí, pues básicamente es todo lo que perdí la renta.
He says he needed to start working again. The lost income from last week, that was money for his rent.
Pues no sé, hay mucha incertidumbre.
He says there's so much uncertainty. He doesn't know when the winery will resume normal operations. There will be help for workers like Guerrero and Garcia from the federal government. I found Garcia later that day, heading into a nonprofit called La Luz to find about assistance in the city of Sonoma. She's going to need it. She and her mom say they're taking care of two elderly relatives and a cousin with autism, all who had to evacuate too and can't go to a shelter.
Like to be in a shelter, for example, it would be a chaos.
They say they spent $2,000 in rentals already. They're looking for another place, but Garcia says the only rentals available are out of their price range.
I mean, that would be my whole paycheck of 2 weeks, you know, and that's just not okay.
It's one more thing to worry about, but Garcia says at least her family is together and safe. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Jabala Romero.
And quick note, later on All Things Considered, former President Obama returns to the campaign trail for a gubernatorial candidate. That story later on ATC. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.